Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Next on News One Now, former President Bill Clinton clashes with some Black Lives Matter protesters in Philadelphia. We will talk to those activists right here live on News One Now in just a moment. What in the world is with these out-of-control school cops? A 12-year-old girl body slammed to the ground. What must be done to get these cops under control? What's going on with minority students in these gifted and talented programs? Why are they not getting a fair shot at success? Also, hunger is increasing in America. I'll talk with a woman out of Dallas who has fed millions as a result through her organization. Also, the cast of the play, I'm Still Your Mama, joins us in the studio. Folks, it's time to bring the funk on News One Now, TV One.
Okay, I heard it. Can I answer? No, you see, here's the thing. I like protesters, but the ones that won't let you answer are afraid of the truth. That's a simple rule. Be afraid. Be very, very afraid.
That's former President Bill Clinton getting a little testy with a couple of Black Lives Matter protesters during a campaign rally for his wife, former Secretary Hillary Clinton, yesterday in Philadelphia. The protesters interrupted the rally several times, accusing Bill Clinton of damaging the Black community by passing the controversial crime bill in 1994. Clinton fired back, defending the bill.
He was the chairman of the committee that had jurisdiction over this crime bill. I had an assault weapons ban in it. I had money for inner city kids, for out of school activities. We had 110,000 police officers so we could put people on the street, not in these military vehicles, and the police would look like the people they were policing. We did all of that. And Biden said, you can't pass this bill, the Republicans will kill it if you don't put more sentencing in. I talked to a lot of African-American groups. They thought Black Lives Mattered. They said, take this bill because our kids are being shot in the street by gangs. You are defending the people who caused young people to go out and take guns. When somebody won't hush and listen to you, that ain't democracy. They're afraid of the truth. Don't you be afraid of the truth. Don't you be afraid of the truth. If you think it was bad, in the 1990s, if you think record increases in income and record low unemployment, record decreases in poverty, and record small businesses forming was bad, you ought to go with them. Otherwise, you better elect Hillary president so we can get this country going again.
The former president's comments sparked a firestorm on Twitter, with many saying Clinton is accusing Black Lives Matter of defending criminals. So did he go too far, or was Bill Clinton right to defend himself? All right, folks, it seems like the crime bill from the mid-90s continues to haunt the Clintons. In February, of course, a protester interrupted Secretary Clinton's fundraiser, saying she was not a super predator. Secretary Clinton used the phrase while defending her husband's crime bill during his reelection campaign in 1996. So let's get right to it, talking about this particular issue. Let's go to Philadelphia via Skype. Are the protesters from yesterday's event, Erica Mines and Rufus Farmer. They are both activists for the Philly Coalition for Real Justice. And also in the studio in D.C., our panel, attorney A. Scott Bolden, a partner with Reed Smith Law Firm, Allison Schneider, a Republican strategist, and Dr. Cleo Monago, the CEO of Black Men's Exchange. And so I want to talk about the both of you yesterday being at that particular rally. So this exchange actually was about 11 minutes, that total exchange. Why was it important for you to go to that rally to confront former President Bill Clinton?
It was important because here in the city of Philadelphia, we have major issues around police militarization and occupation in our communities. We have the same crimes that are increasing the mass incarcerations and the violence, not only just against Black men, but we see it's also rising with Black women and especially Black youth. And the issue around policing and the numbers that we are seeing in our communities come directly from Bill Clinton putting 110,000 more officers in our communities and through the prison expansion program that was implemented through the 1994 crime bill.
Rufus, he made a point talking about then-Senator Joe Biden, who actually was the author of this particular bill. He is now President Barack Obama's vice president. Why are folks not criticizing Biden for his role? Because, again, he was the one who shepherded this bill through the United States Senate. Why is all the focus just on Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton?
Good morning. I think that a lot of people may not know about Vice President Biden's role in the bill.
But again, though, I mean, my point is, a lot of folks love President Barack Obama. He chose Vice President Joe Biden to be his running mate. And so, yes, Bill Clinton signed it into law. He also championed it. But again, you have Biden. You also have a number of, as President Clinton said, a number of African-Americans in the Congressional Black Caucus at the time who were calling for an expansive crime omnibus bill that covered a lot of different things, as he said. And so what about them? Some of them are still in Congress.
Yes.
That doesn't make it correct, regardless of who endorsed it, who signed off on it. That doesn't make it correct. Vice President Biden does deserve criticism for it. However, Vice President Biden was not the one in Philadelphia yesterday.
But here's why I'm asking that question. I haven't seen any rallies where anybody from Black Lives Matter, any activists, have confronted Vice President Joe Biden. And again, this is not, for me, this is not a question of defending President Bill Clinton, but I'm asking the question, why single out Clinton? Why not expand it to the number of people who were involved with this bill, whether it was the person who sponsored it, who wrote it, who drove it through Congress, whether it was House Black Caucus members in the House who actually voted for it. Senator Bernie Sanders also voted for it. And, of course, you have President Bill Clinton who signed it into law.
Well, Mr. Martin, just to reiterate, it was the former President Bill Clinton that stepped in front of us yesterday in Philadelphia. He was given a speech. We had the opportunity to address him, not Vice President Biden, not anyone else who endorsed or signed off on that bill. Also, it is the former president's wife who is running for president. So I think it's imperative that we address former President Bill Clinton and even Hillary Clinton.
And if I can add to that, we take criticism with all of the politicians who signed off on that crime bill. We don't hold one accountable any less than the others. We have the same criticisms of Bernie Sanders. We have the same criticism of the Congressional Black Caucus. We have the same criticism of Joe Biden. None of them are exempt from this idea or this whole issue around the 1994 crime bill. But again, Hillary Clinton is running for president. If Joe Biden would have showed up in Philadelphia, he would have been challenged the very same way.
Absolutely.
We don't have any regards over any of the politicians that are currently in office in D.C. right now, because if all of them participate in the criminalization of Black folks, then they are all guilty.
So both of you showed up there in Philadelphia. What is it that you want Secretary Clinton to do?
First of all, we would like for Hillary Clinton to stop profiting off of people's pains, specifically Black women who have lost their loved ones through two unarmed killings of Black men and women.
How is she, Erica, how is she profiting off of Black people's pain?
Well, to be quite honest, you cannot be against police assaults, assassinations, the unjust killings of Black people, and then also be for the death penalty. That is a contradiction, because we already know that because of the 1994 crime bill that actually put a lot of police officers in our communities, this is the reasons why we have a lot of unjust murders happening throughout the country. And so you can't be against policing in one way and then still be for the death penalty, knowing that we have cases such as like Kalief Browder out of New York, who did not even commit a crime and served over 2 years in jail, and then he came out unstable and committed suicide. It wasn't Kalief Browder that killed himself, it was the state, and it was because of the issues around policing in our communities that was allowed to happen. And we already know that.
But with the Kalief Browder, I got to ask you this question though, but wouldn't the Kalief Browder issue, wouldn't that be one for New York Governor Cuomo, for New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, two other Democrats, two liberals?
No, it's a question around policing altogether. It's a question around how we are constantly criminalized in our communities and how the police interact with us. It's not separate from Pennsylvania and New York. This is a national problem that we have with police when it comes to the way that they interact with us in our communities. And so that is... We already know that there are people who are, just over the past years, we can count for the numerous people who have been exonerated, who have served 30, 40, 50 plus years in life because they were falsely accused of crimes that they did not commit. And so we know that there are people who have been unjustly executed through the death penalty. And so we know that there are faulty systems in the police system. We know that is a racist system. And so,
So you would like Hillary Clinton to renounce her support of the death penalty. What else, when it comes to criminal justice reform, would you like to see Hillary Clinton do?
To be quite honest, I would like for Hillary Clinton, when it comes to the black community, to stop treading around the issues and think that she can just politely brush over them and think that because she says Black Lives Matter, like, then that means that she's doing the right thing. And we
you
already
said the
know,
issues. What issues? Here's why I'm asking these questions. Because, again, if we're talking about accountability and challenging politicians, let's be specific with them to say we want to see this. So you mentioned renouncing her position on the death penalty. What else?
To be quite honest, I can't speak universally for everyone on this issue around what I would like or what Hillary.
Right. I'm not asking everyone. I mean, just you and Rufus. I'm asking the two of you, because the two of you were there yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would like for her to stand up against the crimes that her husband actually committed in our communities. I would like for her to admit to them. Unfortunately, sorry is not a way to do it. I would like for her to begin petitioning for the decrease in prison expansions, especially here in Pennsylvania. I would like for her to just admit to the atrocity that has accumulated through the actions of her husband, through the whole mandated three strikes law. I would like for them to start implementing programs and dealing with the issues around prisons, not just black men, women, but the youth as well, because the youth are also being targeted as well. I would like for them to also speak to the fact that they decrease money in public education, and it is the reason why we have underfunded schools, is the reason why we have more police in schools than we do have nurses and social workers now. And this is the reason why we have like such issues or huge issues around policing, police brutality, and things like that. I would like
Let me play this here. You guys should be able to hear this here. This was President Bill Clinton, because you talked about owning up to that particular crime bill. This is what President Bill Clinton had to say in July when he addressed the NAACP.
The president spoke a long time yesterday and very well about the criminal justice reform, and I appreciate what he has done. But I want to say a few words about it, because I signed a bill that made the problem worse, and I want to admit it. In that bill, there were longer sentences. And most of these people are in prison under state law, but the federal law set a trend. And that was overdone. We were wrong about that. That percentage of it, we were wrong about.
So, Erica and Rufus, when you hear President Clinton say 8 months ago that we were wrong about it, is that an acknowledgement that they made some mistakes with that 1994 crime bill?
Admitting that they were wrong about it 8 months ago, it doesn't correct everything. It doesn't make it right. It doesn't erase what happened.
Right.
If you talk to, you know, the families of some of the people that have been incarcerated, former President Clinton just admitting that it was wrong is not enough. They need to do more than that. Furthermore, what he said yesterday to us, directly to us, was not in the same vein. That he basically accused us of supporting drug dealers and you know, things of that sort. So it was a little bit of a different tone yesterday. I'm sure you saw it.
Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, first of all, Eric and Rufus, we certainly appreciate you joining us right here on TV One. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, then I want to go to my panel right now. Cleo, I want to start with you. And it's this idea of tone. So I think people, when they saw the video from yesterday, and then you saw that clip we played from the NAACP speech, again, yesterday it really was about an 11-minute section at the NAACP. It really was about a 3-minute section where he talked about the 1994 crime bill. Is it a question of how the Clintons are answering these questions? Should they be showing more sympathy, more empathy, more compassion, as opposed to coming off as defending the crime bill?
Well, I think there's a perception issue here in terms of what the Clintons see and what people in the community see, and I see what the community sees. And I think that what Bill Clinton said yesterday kind of contradicts his apology, because he accused the people there who were protesting the bills that Bill Clinton had passed that created a lot of criminals, quote unquote, in the community. He accused them of defending criminals. And what is not a part of none of the Clintons' analysis is the school to prison pipeline, the circumstances in the community that leads to this behavior among some of our youth where they act out. He's not talking about the impact of building prisons and the impact of police brutality and how that traumatizes people. There's a film that came out that anybody can see on Netflix called Crips and Bloods Made in America, which gives a very brilliant depiction of what happened in these communities that led a lot of these young boys into so-called violent behavior. A lot of people don't realize that the black community before the 70s was one of the most safest places black people could be in this country, because the black communities were a lot less violent. So some things occurred that exacerbated violence that is not part of the analysis that Bill or Hillary has. And for him to say that they're defending criminals is very disrespectful and minimizes any kind of previous apology.
Allison?
And one thing I think that might be missing from this discussion is that criminal justice reform is a bipartisan issue. When we talk about mandatory minimums, they have disproportionately affected the black community, and youthful convictions shouldn't deter higher aspirations for the rest of your life. And unfortunately, that's what we're seeing right now. So I think we need to come together to move the ball forward and reform the criminal justice system.
Well, first of all, Scott, I mean, you got a bill right now that's frankly stuck in the U.S. Senate and and the House. You do have some bipartisan support, but they frankly haven't moved on it. But when you look at this here, Scott, do you believe it makes sense to relitigate, if you will, what took place in 1994? Do you believe that Hillary Clinton should be held accountable for a crime bill that her husband signed into law, that Vice President Joe Biden, as a U.S. senator from Delaware, pushed through, and that a couple of dozen of Congressional Black Caucus members also voted for?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is a complicated story, and I'm glad you're doing it, but this is an extraordinary exchange yesterday for these 11 minutes. It just was extraordinary, and it highlights the problem. On one hand, communities of color, who are you going to call? You got to still call the police. Without the crime bill, you'd still have the abuses and all the other issues communities of color have with the police. It's very complicated, and they're all right, and they're all wrong. The reality, though, that I saw yesterday was that the Democrats are going to have this problem once we get to the presidential election, because you've got Black Lives Matter who accuse the Democrats of creating this pipeline from community to prison, and then you're going to have the Republicans, and whenever Bill Clinton shows up, he's there to promote his wife and advocate for his wife, and he winds up defending his record, and then they're putting his record on her record, blaming both of them, and then even they're at odds with the Obama administration. This is complicated, and look for more of these protests from not just Republicans, from Black Lives Matter and going forward. This presidential election is going to be crazy, man.
And to the three of you, look, President Bill Clinton has talked about how repealing Glass-Steagall did not go so well. He's talked about one of the worst bills that he signed was the Telecommunications Act of 1996 that caused massive changes in the media industry as well. And so to all three of you, how much can voters hold Hillary Clinton accountable for the policies of her husband when he was president? And should they? Allison?
Well, I think insofar as Hillary Clinton is associating herself with her husband's policies and having him on the stump advocating for her, they are right to consider his record when they think about what she would look like as a president.
And she's the one use her own lips to call people super predators. Well, she said that. It wasn't her husband. He treated people like super predators, but she actually articulated that. But one thing I just want to say is that what might be helpful to the Clintons is to get a clue and learn why there's cause and effect in the black community and or other communities that have these so-called criminal problems and what leads people from the pipeline to prison. They don't have an analysis of that, therefore they can't address it.
Scott?
Well, I think it's unfair to blame Hillary Clinton, but then Hillary Clinton puts the issue before the public when Bill Clinton advocates for her and campaign stumps for her. I think what would be important for the Democrats and Hillary Clinton is to not only strike a different tone, you're absolutely right about that, but two, and more importantly, to lay out her record compared to his record, or at least both of their record, and either you're going to defend it or you're going to apologize about it in regard to the criminal justice system, because while it's 20 years later, our communities of color are still suffering from the same problems, some caused by the police and some caused by our own communities and the bad actors in our communities.
All right, folks, hold tight 1 second. We come back. We're going to talk about a cop in a school body slamming a 12-year-old girl. Also, what is also going on when a black legislator in Arkansas, let's just say she claps back at one of her fellow legislators. We're going to show you that video. And talented and gifted programs, why are they hurting black students? All of that right here on News 1 Now on TV 1.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News 1 Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV 1.
Folks, Republicans have a habit of invoking slavery when it comes to issues they don't agree with. Well, that took place in Arkansas. Well, there was a debate about the issue of Medicare on the floor. Democratic State Senator Stephanie Flowers, she blasted Republican State Senator Terry Rice when he tried to liken Medicaid expansion to slavery.
We are enslaving future generations, our children and grandchildren, to debt that we are irresponsibly putting on their credit card. And that, to me, is unbelievable.
Well, that didn't sit well with Flowers. She immediately fired back.
I would never vote for a bill that would enslave anybody. And I don't think that's what we're doing when we are providing health care for the poorest Americans and our hands in the future. In this case, I just have a serious problem with that kind of statement. You know, humanity dictates that we ought to give people an opportunity to have a healthy lifestyle. That's not enslavement. And I'm willing to have my son and any grandchild to help somebody out when they're sick.
All right, folks, let's go to my panel. I'm just trying to understand, why do Republicans continue to use slavery, enslave, plantation, all of these? You're not going to win using that language. I'm just saying.
Well, I didn't know that they mentioned welfare in the Bible. He said it was unbiblical. Is that chapter
well,
Corinthians?
You're in the South. This is the South.
Okay.
But Roland, let me just say this. The reality is that, you know, taking care of poor people, I've said this on TV and I've said it to you privately, that taking care of poor people is really, really expensive. And it's a struggle with Republicans who want to hold the line, and then our communities of color, but more importantly, Democrats who want to provide for those. Now, none of us are socialists here, but it's an expensive process and somebody's got to pay for it. But I agree with you. Using the term enslavement, slavery, plantation to make your point, because sometimes, somehow, we're in 2016. It's okay to use that as you compare it to other race-neutral political issues. That's just not a good start and not a good finish.
Well, Allison, it's expensive, but frankly, it's a lot more expensive when you're giving massive tax breaks to the wealthy or even the significant amount of money that goes to corporations for research and development from the federal government. But again, why do Republicans continue to go down this path? Here you're talking about Medicaid. Well, we're enslaving our... Look, America does not have a good history with slavery. And, you know, and here's the deal. We challenge them, people, politicians, when it comes to using the Holocaust. Guess what? The Holocaust also didn't happen in America. Slavery did.
Absolutely. I don't understand why Republicans use this tone-deaf language either. I think it's very clear that the Republican Party needs to grow. It needs to be the big tent party. And these kind of misstatements are the things that turn people away.
Well, I don't think they're misstatements. I think it's they are indicators of their mentality. You know, they have a master-slave mentality. They also want to dehumanize people and make them into caricatures instead of human beings in need. I mean, one of the things they never consider, because my family was on welfare for a short time, is that people use welfare sometimes as a temporary stay while they're developing their lives. It's not necessarily something they stay on as slaves. So, but see, like I always say all the time, let's not try to have a rational perspective of irrational people who have this idea in their mind that they're superior. But it's why they keep trying to refer to everybody else as slaves.
And also, let's look at it this way. You know, we often hear from conservatives and even some liberals that, look, not all cops are bad. The majority of cops, they are good. Well, guess what? Not all folks on welfare are trying to steal from the government. I think many of these folks need to go back to look at history as to why welfare was created. You look at the working poor in this country. There are people who are trying to make ends meet. We literally are paying farmers right now in Iowa not to grow food, to grow their crops. We're giving them subsidies. That's also welfare.
Yeah, but you know, these politicians and these elected officials, state, local, and federal level, they're not knowing, they don't know their history, quite frankly. They're not sensitive to the plantation and the slavery, because that was 200 years ago. But you're right, they're sensitive to other things like the Holocaust. And quite frankly, we need to hold them accountable for this. So I'm glad you're doing this story. But we don't seem, whether you're black, white, yellow, brown, don't hold politicians to accountability for using those terms. But if you use other terms of history of other people, you certainly are held accountable. So it's really on us as people of color to not only educate, but also to protest and hold them accountable when they try to use hyperbole like this to do it.
And Allison, last thing here, Congressman Jill Clyburn has a thing called the Clyburn Amendment. And what that calls for is when it comes to any bills in Congress, that what they should do is 10% of those funds will go to counties where 20% or more of the people have lived below the poverty line for 30 years. Two-thirds of the 450 counties that fall under that are in Republican congressional districts. That means that the people who are actually on welfare is a whole bunch of white folks in Republican districts. And so I don't get why conservatives, Republicans, don't get that. They're talking about their own voters.
Well, I think Republicans want to give people a hand up and not a handout. And that's what people are looking for. A job is better than a government program. I think we can all agree on that. And that's where the Republicans are trying to move the debate.
Yeah, but the deal, though, is when you have policies where you are providing Medicare expansion, Medicaid expansion, which is providing them health care, so we're not actually having to bear more of the burden later on, that makes sense. When you're talking about the issue of welfare, that's not, oh, you're getting a handout. And here's the deal. Farmers in Iowa right now are getting handouts, but that's not called welfare. That's called subsidies. Corporations in America are getting handouts. That's called research and development dollars. We literally are building stadiums for billionaire sports owners, and that's called economic development. So why don't we call welfare the exact same thing?
Well, I hate to be redundant because people hear me say this on the show a lot, but it's called racism. My brother, it's racism. It's dehumanizing one group to perpetuate the myth of them being having lesser value, and they're users and they're problematic. And the white people deserve, they deserve subsidies because they're superior, and they deserve those gifts and those priorities and those privileges because they're white. Let's be real about the perception that people have.
All right, folks, let me go to a break now. We come back, we're going to show you this disturbing video of a school cop body slamming a 12-year-old girl to the ground. Also, gifted and talented programs. Why are black kids being frozen out and treated differently in these programs? All of that next on News One Now on TV One.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Janessa, chill! Oh! Janessa, you okay?
As you saw there, 12-year-old Janessa Valdez was slammed to the ground by a San Antonio Independent School officer at Rhodes Middle School. Officer Joshua Kim has been placed on administrative leave after the March 29th incident surfaced on YouTube earlier this week. Janessa and her mother, Gloria Valdez, were contacted and asked if they thought the officer could have done anything else besides body slamming her to the ground.
Pushed me away instead of dropping me.
And that's the first thing I told him. Why didn't you just grab her and just move her away? Why did you have to slam her like that to the ground?
Go to our panel, Scott Bolden. We also have Allison Schneider and Cleo Monago. Folks, this again is another example of when you have police officers who have one mindset in schools, who think and act as if they're operating on the streets. You don't body slam a 12-year-old girl or even a 12-year-old boy.
Just outrageous, man. And, you know, you and I have talked about this before. The origins of resource officers was to keep the students and others in the school safe because the students, quote, they could not have that control. You introduce the police officers into that population. They go through special training, supposedly go through special training, and this is what you get. You're supposed to de-escalate whether you're on the street or in a closed environment like the school system. You de-escalate. You do not escalate. And the other thing that's interesting whenever we see these videos, and these happen all around the country, Roland, is that a lot of this violence by the police, these offense officers, not resource officers, are against young black and Hispanic women. They're against some males, but it's against women, these young girls as well. That can't be the answer. And he's on leave. He should be on leave without pay. But more importantly, he ought to be fired because the video speaks for itself. There's not much left to investigate here, is it?
Absolutely. And I'd add, if a parent did that, it'd be child abuse.
Absolutely.
So it's unacceptable.
Well, in terms of context, I go back to what I say before is that we saw what made video this time. This kind of stuff happens all the time.
Yeah.
You know, the dehumanization of children, black and Latino, predominantly black from my experience, being pushed around, beat up, sometimes killed and disfigured by police or law enforcement, in quotes, and schools as well as in the community. It's a normalist culture. So black people need to step up and not allow it anymore.
But when is it ever appropriate? When is it ever appropriate in our schools to do this as a police offense officer? I just can't get my arms around it. How could you look at that as a school administrator, principal, or school board and say, this is what we've introduced to our school system, to our kids, to our families. They're here to learn, not to be body slammed.
Folks, speaking of schools, gifted and talented programs at schools offer high-achieving students additional opportunities to excel. I went to a Vanguard school when I was in elementary school and, of course, went to a magnet school in high school. But recent studies show that black students are 66% less likely to be admitted to gifted programs than white students with equal academic achievement scores. That's followed by Latino students, who come in at 47%. However, Asian students are 44% more more likely to be accepted than white students. But now, there are a number of contributing factors along with the student's race, such as family income and the race of the teacher recommending the student to the programs. Joining us via Skype to break this thing down from New York is educator and author Jose Vilsen, and still with the panel. So, Jose, we talk about income inequality. We have educational inequality, where, frankly, when it comes to our schools, our kids are not able to get into these programs. And we know for a fact, and again, I went to these schools. My brother did, my sister did. Extra resources are targeted. And the opportunity for you to get scholarships, the kind of offers from colleges and universities, is far different. And so not only are we being frozen out of jobs as adults, we're being frozen out of the education that puts us in position for those kind of jobs.
That's right. It's all about the continuum. I feel like that these are all symptoms of institutional racism. So when you look carefully at the numbers, you start seeing that not only are students not being admitted into these gifted and talented programs, but you're also seeing the decimation of the black and brown teaching population across the board. As of right now, we're about 17% people of color in teaching staffs all across the nation, 3% of which are male teachers of color. And of course, as you join up with that, you start to see that teachers of color will more likely recommend students of color to gifted and talented programs because we can see beyond some of the, I guess, the cultural norms of what it means to be gifted and talented and really look at their academic prowess.
So what should parents be doing? What should they be saying? Because, look, we have a whole litany of things that we can be protesting. And again, being frozen out of these programs certainly hurts black and Latino kids later in life.
We have to be able to start young. I feel like a lot of our parents don't have the agency within the schools to be able to say, hey, look at my student for the student that they are. Look at their intellect. Look at their academic prowess. Are they able to meet the certain standards? And if they are, then they should be able to be admitted. Do we have enough people who are culturally competent within those staffs as well to address the issues that are happening? And unfortunately, we don't at writ large.
I want to go to our panel there to Scott, Allison, and Cleo. And again, I don't think people understand is, and we discuss it on this show a lot, when you talk about the racial inequities in America, when I talk about, you know, first slave in 1619, 397-year history, you're going through Jim Crow, a laws passed, African-Americans not fully technically free to 1970. We're only talking about 46 years where we have been able to access all that it means to be an American, and that's even not even fully the case. This is an example in these gifted and talented programs.
Well, it would really be great if everybody that came into a high school or grade school had access to these programs and had the not the IQ but the aptitude, if you will, to be tested for these gifted programs. But that's simply not the case. We can't rely on the school systems to place our kids in these programs. The reality is, watch this though. The reality is that. If you look at the studies that show kids who are not testing at a very high level, kids who may even be acting up, if you move those kids, black, white, yellow, or brown, into a gifted program, their test scores, their conduct automatically rises, if you will, because you're putting them in an environment around kids who are gifted, who are talented, and who get all this extra attention and money and resources. That's what we need to be doing in our public and private school systems, because those programs will work even if you're keeping kids who are not testing at that level. Their scores and everything about them and their academic record goes up. We know this to be true.
Gotcha. Cleo.
Well, on this issue, I'm mixed. Of course, students who are talented and gifted should get the proper opportunity to showcase that and be in a system that's going to promote and affirm that. But one of the things that gets a lot of our children bewildered in the school system is the curriculum. The curriculums are not affirming of black people. You only get to talk about being black in February. And even when kids who are really, really intelligent sometimes gets traumatized and demoralized by the lack of seeing themselves in the curriculum and learning process, which takes them out of the possibility of being in these gifted programs because they're not feeling connected to what they have to learn.
Mm-hmm. Allison, and look, I often hear Republicans talk about school choice, and I'm a huge school choice supporter, but this is an example, again, where if you don't create the opportunities and you get rid of the inequities, you're going to continue to see these racial education gaps.
I totally agree. I think until we get to the root of the problem, which is keeping children trapped in underperforming schools, we're going to continue to see these inequities. We need
no,
to.
No, but actually, that, no, but this problem here is not kids just in underfunded schools. This is also about kids who are eligible to be in these gifted and talented programs, and they're being frozen out.
Sure, and I'd like to see more kids eligible for that because they're getting the quality education that they need right from the beginning. And parents, to your point, Cleo, parents are able to choose the curriculum, the setup that works best for their student. And until we see that broadened, I think that we're going to continue to see this.
But what Jose, about Jose, your final comment.
I was just going to say, there's also all these cultural signifiers as well, right? So what does it mean to be gifted and talented? And often that has to do with Eurocentric norms.
That's
so
right.
Then when
That's
you look
right.
at kids, you say, you know, they're standing up too much. They talk too much. They're too loud. They're too yelly and they're too brash. Instead of saying, wow, the student might actually have something to say, and they may actually have the agency to be able to express that feeling, and maybe let's find a way to gear all of these emotions and feelings and the ways that they approach the material in a way that affirms them and gives them a sort of sense of agency in their own schooling.
Yes. All right, Jose Vilsen, we certainly appreciate it. Thank you so very much. Scott Allison, as well as Cleo, appreciate you as well being on the panel. Coming up, folks, Cheryl Action Jackson breaks down what you can do to help end hunger in America. Plus, we're joined by the cast of the play I'm Still Your Mama. All of that, News One Now on TV One.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Between long-term unemployment, underemployment, and the increased cost of living, hunger is becoming a growing epidemic in America. According to the Hungry in America 2014 study, 1 in 7 people in our nation use local food banks. I recently talked with Cheryl Action Jackson, who was moved by the staggering numbers and her own personal bout with hunger to create Minnie's Food Pantry, a nonprofit organization in Dallas that has provided more than 3 million healthy meals to those in need. She began by explaining how she's working to get Congress involved in the fight against hunger.
You're absolutely right, Roland. It's very, very sad, and that's why we're working with our Congress and our statesmen to talk about, you know, creating acts that will tell not just the farmers, but the companies that, like Walmart, that are throwing food away. It's going to expire in 2 days. Let's throw it away. Now they're producing bills that says that if Walmart donates to us or any corporation donates to us, that they can't be sued if someone gets sick from the food, because that's the story that they were using. We're not going to donate to any food pantries because we're going to get sued if someone gets sick.
Right.
And so we're really, really thankful that now, at least in the state of Texas, my Congressman Sam Johnson, he is very, very, he's an advocate for what we are doing. And also Senator Van Horn, I mean, he wrote a bill that was passed that protects our companies. And so now we do have the Walmart and the grocery stores from Kroger's, everybody, 7 days a week, we have trucks on the ground picking up food.
This is one of those issues, again, I don't think the average person really understands. When I was in Chicago reporting on this, the school district was feeding upwards of 40,000 kids a day.
Right.
There are a number of children who literally are going to school right now, showing up hungry, did not have a meal last night.
I love that, Roland, that you understand. There's a lot of children going to bed hungry. And the other thing, too, Roland, though, is that our kids are being responsible. So you see all the food banks now putting together programs for these kids to go home with a backpack of food. Kids should be going to school to learn, not to take a backpack of food home. They should have food pantries that give out healthy meals, which is what I set on an effort to do, is to create a food pantry that when you step into our food pantry, you're going to get a complete meal for your family and healthy meals. From the vegetables to the fruits to the complete meals. You know, back growing up, if mom made spaghetti, we had meatballs if we were blessed enough. Or if we had chicken, then we had, you know, something sides to go with it. And so at Minnie's Food Pantry, we really started literally roll out a red carpet, and people are walking a red carpet to get a healthy meal. And we've garnered the attention of the world by how we're doing it.
Now, you have to deal with this. Well, what was that circumstance? Was it as a child or as an adult?
Well, you know, both. My mother had 7 kids, and then she brought in my 2 cousins. And so, you know, some days we ate cookies for dinner, and we thought mom was just the coolest mom in the world for giving us cookies. But then after my husband and I got married, we were collectively working five jobs. You know, he was working for the city, I was working, we were working Domino's Pizza, we were doing Dallas Morning News. So we were not the individuals that was trying to get help just to be getting help. And I went to the government office and I tried, I said, you know, my husband, my father told my husband, if you can't take care of my daughter, send her back home. And so my husband said, please don't tell your dad, because we weren't eating. And so I went to the government. I applied for food stamps. And Roland, when I say so, it was the most horrific experience in my life. And I just remember they said, you didn't get qualified because you made too much money, but I wasn't making enough money to feed my family, which is a story of people today. And I got home and I just cried. They gave me this brown paper bag. And in this bag, when I started taking stuff out in gratitude, sure gratitude, I didn't identify with any of the food that was in the bag. And I can see me going down.
What was in it?
You know what, Roland, I can't even remember what was in it. The one thing I do remember were beets. And I'm like, okay, now I know these are beets, but I've never cooked beets. And then the can was dented. It looked like it was 2 or 3 years old. And I was like, I still can't make a meal. And I just asked God never to let me forget that moment. And when my father passed away Father's Day weekend, I wanted to do something to honor my mother. And so creating the food pantry, God said, how do you feel when you needed food? So create that experience. And that's how Minnie's Food Pantry was born. Minnie's is named after my mom, and we created a food pantry. I said, well, what would life be like? You know, life got better. I started working the red carpet and interviewing celebrities. I started working for Emmett Smith, watching him sign his autograph, and people would bring food, canned food, or they would bring a toy. And I was like, if this man can use his signature to feed the hungry, what can I do? And I set out on the path, and we've been blessed.
So what's the one thing you want those watching to do? Because if someone says, well, look, I'm eating, I'm fine, what can they do to drive this issue?
You know what? They can look down. You just made a good point. If you're eating, look down at the end of your meal and see how much you're wasting. And if you're spending $10 or $20 on a meal, instead of spending that $20, drop it down to $10, because you're not eating. 40% of the food that we eat is thrown away. So donate. Find a food pantry or a food bank that you can donate to and help feed these people. There are a lot of people that are hungry that we can really help. That's all. Just be a voice, you know? I was in New York City and I was getting ready to go on TV to talk about this, and I saw this lady sitting there, and she had the We'll Work for Food signs. And Roland, I literally stopped and I sat in her shoes. I sat with her and I held her sign. And this lady looked at me and she started crying, and she said, everybody just walks by. And she said, I had it good. I lost my job. Da, da, da. And I gave this woman a meal and I took her to my room and I just bought t-shirts. And I said, here are t-shirts, white t-shirts, you know. And she just was like blown away. You know, we turn our heads. We don't want to think that it happens, but the face of hunger is not that lady. Seriously, that's sitting on the ground. The face of hunger could be the person that's working for you that's not making enough money because they have 3 or 4 kids, and they're afraid to tell you or me that they're hungry. So I just say, be conscious about the people you love and about their surroundings, because I was one of those faces of hunger.
And of course, for folks out there, no matter where you live, I guarantee you there's some local food bank there, whether it's tied to a church or a nonprofit.
Yeah. On my way here, I saw them, and my assistant said, what are we going to do? I said, we'll be on our way back. We'll go see them. We'll go talk to them, and that's what we'll do. We'll step in, we'll hear their stories, and we'll help them.
All right. Cheryl Jackson, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Roland, for having me.
Up next, the cast of the stage play I'm Still Your Mama, right here on News One Now.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
All right, folks, I'm Still Your Mama is a stage play about a single mother who does any and everything to take care of her children and the many challenges she encounters along the way. The play is directed by Snoop Robinson, stars Keith Robinson from the movie Dreamgirls, and Lo London from the series Bad Girls Club. They join us right now. Folks, how y'all doing?
We're good.
Hello.
Good.
All right. Well, sorry I couldn't be there in D.C. Got to do some work here in New York. So you guys are going to be at the Warner Theater in D.C. with this, traveling around the country. What is fun about this? I mean, you got a serious topic, but clearly you've got fun tied to it as well.
Yeah, we do actually. The character Uncle Charles is kind of a development of the actual show. The show deals with forgiveness, and a lot of times when you're dealing with single parent homes, you know, you go through the issue of the father or the mother that's not, that the kid has issues with their parents. So it's a real cool situation.
Keith, obviously being in a movie or a television show, same for you, Lo, is different than being on the stage. It's a whole different energy and dynamic.
Indeed. I think with plays, the payoff is immediate. So you kind of know if the joke works, if the song works, if the scene is moving to people as soon as you deliver it. So that's a lot of fun for me.
Lo?
Yes, coming from reality TV, you just get to be yourself, be natural. But my struggle was learning the lines, trying to interact with the different actors that have been doing it for years. But it came out pretty good, and I'm very confident about tomorrow.
She's doing great.
But this also is a story of, frankly, a lot of folks out there, many folks who are watching us right now.
Right. I agree. And the cool thing about it, the writer DeMarcus Bailey, this story came from, he had a foster home, and some of his foster kids it was three foster kids that really hated their parents so much, but they still loved them because they didn't get a chance to see what exactly that mother could really did for them, but they didn't realize that the mother did everything she could to take care of their kids. And it was just real cool, the story as a whole of DeMarcus Bailey.
And Lo and Keith, what do you, I mean, look, all those are stage plays, entertainment. What do you want someone to walk away with after they see this play?
Me, I can relate to the story because my parents, I went through the same situation with losing my mother for something that she did to take care of her family. So I just want people to understand that your mom is just there to take care of you and have your best interests at heart. So, you know, just because women, men, everyone makes mistakes. So it's just an act of forgiveness. You have to forgive your parents. You have to forgive everyone because at the end of the day, they're doing it. They're sacrificing their time and everything for you.
Keith?
Yeah, I mean, aside from being thoroughly entertained, I guess the bottom line is, you know, you only got one mama, like my mama used to tell me. So I think that's the through line of this entire play. It's just reconciliation, forgiveness, and being entertained along the way. So y'all come on out, D.C., and check it out.
All right, folks, it's going to take place on Saturday at the Warner Theater in Washington, D.C. Go to Ticketmaster.com and LiveNation.com for more information about the stage play, I'm Still Your Mama, traveling around the country. Snoop, Lo, and Keith, we appreciate it. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds on News One Now.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Folks, actress Skye Jackson, known for her role on Disney sitcom Jessie, she turns 14, and rapper Biz Markie turns 52. Akron, Ohio, I'll see you tomorrow at your boys' summit. I got to go. Holla!
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.